Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have a treat in store for you, a man whose acumen, whose insights, whose articulation of the challenges that we face is, I think, among the most important in the country at the moment. He is a good friend, as well as a cherished colleague of mine at our Center for Security Policy, and on his own television show that would be Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin is, among many other attributes, the author of several best-selling books, including Secret Weapon, Game Plan, According to Plan, and most recently, the one that is prominently featured there before him, Pirate Money. We're going to be talking a little bit about that in a moment. But before we do, Kevin, I just want to say, I really mean this with all sincerity. You have had a track record of, well, looking over the horizon, as they say, at challenges facing our country in the economic battle space, as you call it, among other places. And in particular, I wanted you to talk a little bit about a blog that you posted at your blog outlet,
Global Economic Warfare. Back in 2018,
globaleconomicwarfare.com, that back in 2018 anticipated with uncanny precision the mess we find ourselves in at the moment. Talk a little bit about both what you've written way back then and how you figured this out so clearly.
Well, Frank, it wasn't all you had to do was look, and thank you for letting me be on Securing America. Bottom line, in 2018, I wrote about the winds of war, and it was like a four-part blog, and it talked about what the Chinese were doing, what the Russians were doing, what the Islamic radicals, however we wish to term them, maybe they're the mainstream according to the Quran, according to the faith, but certainly radical in terms of modern society were doing. And the bottom line is they were planning a combination attack. It's based on unrestricted warfare that the Chinese Communist Party had produced in 1999. It talks in there about don't just take one form of warfare. You attack, it's unrestricted. You use every means possible, which means you're going to bankrupt your enemy by rushing across their borders. You're going to use cyber attacks. You're going to use biological warfare attacks. It's an all-at-once takedown. And it combined what Vladimir Putin had talked about, which was breaking up the United States through open borders and pushing the Ponzi scheme of our debt. So you start a war in Israel or in Ukraine or whatever, and America rushes in and our answer is to spend money, to send troops, to give weapons and so forth. They can do a $100,000 attack like Osama bin Laden on 9/11, and we respond with trillions of dollars of response. And that's essentially preparing to bankrupt us. And so that's what I was writing about in 2018.
So you're saying basically it was just common sense. You were looking at the facts that were then present and applying common sense to it and coming to the conclusion that this would not end well. And especially, I want to say, all that's true, but I think you also have a capacity to think about how things evolve over time. And in particular, this idea that what many have sort of contemplated as independent actors, all bad guys, to be sure, but nonetheless independent actors, combining forces to accomplish their shared purpose, which is the destruction of the United States, was something that I want to give you credit for, because I think it was, it took more than common sense. It took some really important analytic thinking, and I credit you with it, doing a lot of that. And also, by the way, making it available to all of us on your platform, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, and especially in the battle plans that you guys generate, you and your team, marvelous contribution, I think, to the work that needs to be done here. And so having anticipated where we were going to be, in the future, namely now. Talk a little bit about some of your recommendations, Kevin, in your battle plans, in your economic war room programming, about what we must do to try to contend with now this combined, well, axis of evil, some call it, that is at work at the moment.
Well, number one, my space is economic primarily, and I see the economic drain on America. We are near absolute point of no return bankruptcy in our national debt. Our response has been to spend all of this money, not on the things that would actually protect us, by the way. We're going to remake the entire energy system, but in the and we're going to put everything on the electric grid. But in the process, we're not going to strengthen that electric grid against foreign attack, which is just insane. And that's a part of the unrestricted warfare, is to get us constantly diverted to things. So part of the solutions, you got to make America great again. I hate to say it, but that I wrote that before Donald Trump said it in 2014, is I use a slightly different phrase, but we've got to reduce regulations, grow our economy, get control of our monetary system, which is what the pirate money is about. We've got to just make common sense solutions on the border, and we've come up with a number of those. But to the point, I want to point out that the dollar has been under threat since this book was printed in 1968. This was written by William F. Rickenbacker, who was Eddie Rickenbacker's son. He worked, William Rickenbacker worked for National Review. He was the senior editor of National Review, and Bill Buckley was his immediate boss. And he said, look, this is the path we're on. When I read that next to pirate money, they're almost identical. The covers even look similar. If you notice, it's a black book with gold coins on the cover. They even look similar. When I found that, our friend Bill Federer mentioned William Rickenbacker, so I looked it up, started to study it. We're in a path that has been planned for us by globalists using jihadists, using China, using Russia to take America down. And the answer is to get control of the money system with pirate money.
So you're telling me that you, when you designed the cover for that new book of yours, you had no knowledge of the one that had been published decades before. Fascinating. Kevin, I wanted to, we'll come to pirate money in a moment. I did want to just tease out a little bit further something that you address, because as it happens, as we speak, later in the course of the day, we're going to have one of our Committee on the Present Danger China webinars, to which you have contributed in the past handsomely as a member of our committee. I'm very grateful for all of that. This one is about the weaponization of climate change as a means of engaging in unrestricted warfare of the kind the Chinese Communist Party has been waging against us for some time. And I was moved in part to put this program together. And by the way, folks, all of them, every single one of 120 of them, I think about now, of these webinars are available for free. You can subscribe to them so you don't miss any of the future ones. Just go to presentdangerchina.org to check them out. And I hope you'll especially check this one out. But Kevin, we're talking about the fact that just last week, a guy who the smart money suggests is actually going to be the Democratic Party nominee for president, and that would not be Joe Biden, that would be Gavin Newsom, was in Beijing, China, being romanced to the hilt as he sought new opportunities for his state, not the United States, his state, to make common cause with the Chinese Communist Party on climate change. Talk us through this. On the other side of a very short break, we have to be suspended for a moment. We'll be right back, though, with Kevin Freeman, the author most recently of Pirate Money. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Senate rhinos are relentlessly attacking their colleague, Tommy Tuberville, for wisely insisting that promotions of hundreds of top officers be approved individually, since many embrace a Marxist agenda imperiling our armed forces. Purges of patriots and those who refuse the jab, compounded by critical race brainwashing, are crushing the service's recruitment goals. The Pentagon can, however, find lots of fit young men of color to fill the ranks. It has a program that allows illegal aliens to enlist and get fast-tracked for citizenship. Barack Obama promised to fundamentally transform America. In the course of this third Obama-Biden term, doing that to our military has rapidly advanced and would result in its inevitable takedown if we put foreign jihadists, Chinese special forces, and other enemies in our uniforms. Will any senator stand with Coach Tuberville in exposing and opposing this unfolding disaster? This is Frank Affney.
We're back. We're visiting with Kevin Freeman, the host of his own wonderful television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. You can find it on Blaze TV and other platforms. He is also the author of a book prominently featured before him, Pirate Money, about which we'll speak in a moment. But Kevin, before we do, I put a question to you, and we didn't have time for you to begin to answer it. But the question is basically this. Is the Chinese Communist Party waging a very effective form of economic warfare against our country using climate change and their professed commitment to mitigating it in partnership with us, California, with Joe Biden, as a means of taking down our country?
Oh, there's no question about it. The Chinese have convinced us to give up the natural resources that we have, that we use, that we have in abundance, the ones that they use to depend their electric grid upon, and to replace it with unreliable solar and unreliable wind, where the components are primarily made in China, of course. So they're getting us to do what they won't do and making themselves wealthy in the process. But it doesn't stop there. It also strains our electric grid, which makes us vulnerable to an electromagnetic pulse or other attack on our electric grid, where they could do that and take us down. And that's mentioned in unrestricted warfare as part of the combination attack. So they muster large amounts of capital, and they cyber attack our services. They cause street riots and a political crisis by dividing our nation, which they're doing over Israel right now. They're foisting hatred in America and Black Lives Matter and so forth. And then, of course, they shut down the electric grid and our society collapses. There is no question. And what they're doing is so bad for us. It's bad for the electric grid, but it's also bad for consumers. If you remove Texas Public Policy Foundation, TPPF, just did a recent survey study to determine what does it cost equivalence for an electric car versus a gas car if you remove all of the subsidies. Over the life of the vehicle, it turns out to be $17 a gallon for an electric car equivalent. The only reason it's even close to that is federal and state subsidies from Gavin Newsom, from the federal government, that have allowed it to appear as if it's a good deal for consumers. It's a terrible deal for consumers individually and absolutely horrific collectively. Going down and forcing this path, people should have the option of electric vehicles. The free market should bring them forth. They're wonderful cars. I love everything about them except the mandate that that's the only way you can drive, which is what California has said, past a certain, I think it's 2030, you can't sell gas-powered cars anymore in California. It is an insane plan created by people by the Chinese Communist Party and others to rape America and then take America completely off the map. Yeah. Which is what they've done to Israel.
And there's a Gavin Newsom dimension to those mandates, of course. But also, Kevin, the reality is that the grid of California itself can't sustain everybody in the country, everybody in the in that state turning to electric vehicles. And in addition to the downsides of them, of course, is what do you do with the batteries? This is a increasing concern, not only some safety issues, but also disposing of them and replacing them. And also, Kevin, just another economic warfare thing, the idea that states, not California, as far as I know, but Michigan and Illinois are throwing, in, talk about subsidies, hundreds of millions of dollars at Chinese companies, specifically one called Gotion, to build electric vehicle battery manufacturing facilities in their state, ostensibly to create a lot of jobs. But, you know, as the real cost of those jobs is extraordinary, exorbitant, and unsustainable, I think, to say nothing of having Chinese entities in our heartland, which is also a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect economic warfare. I was talking to Dr. Calvin Beisner, and he and Dr. LeGates are coming up with a new book that's coming out. He asked me to write a cover note on it, and you read it, and you say, this is a scam. It is a complete and absolute utter scam to make China rich and to destroy America at the same time. And politicians like Gavin Newsom are going along with it because it sounds good. And by the way, Elon Musk makes some wonderful electric vehicles. And I think that should be an option for anyone who wants to drive one. But it should not be mandated. It should not be done with government using a gun to force you to do it.
Yeah. And a further thing that I just have to mention on the grid is if they've not only got boku opportunities to take down the grid, but inside of it, they now have some 400 high voltage transformers manufactured in China, which we have reason to believe have back doors that can be commandeered and used to take them down or take down the grid for that matter. This is complete malfeasance on the part of governors and on the part of federal regulators and on the part of Joe Biden and company. It's going to end badly, again, as you warned us of that coming winds of war. Let me turn finally and quickly, Kevin, to pirate money. You've made an incredible contribution in your native state of Texas and now elsewhere across the country to awareness that there's an option here that could be the proper response to, among other things, central bank digital currencies. Give us the quick form of it and an update on how it's coming.
Well, just imagine if you had an optional gold and silver standard that the state would back and defend that you could use instead of paper dollars. You didn't have to use it, but you had the option to use it. It's in the Constitution. It's biblical. It's proven historically. And you had that option so that you could be paid in gold and silver, and you could pay all your bills in gold and silver if you wanted to. And you would never have to use paper money. You could use that and gold and silver. That's what we proposed in the book, Pirate Money. It explains all the history of money, why it works, how it works. The exciting part, Frank, is 18 states have contacted me. I've had individuals in Iowa, in I just got a call from the treasurer of West Virginia, Riley Moore. He says, what is this? People keep calling me and saying, I want this. How do I get this? Talk to our friends in Louisiana. The state freedom caucuses are behind it. AMAC is behind it. Brigitte Gabriel is behind it. The Eagle Forum is behind it. When you read the book, it all makes sense. We could have an optional gold and silver standard. The technology exists. We could implement it tomorrow. I challenge anyone to read the book and then say, no, this is why it won't work, because not one person, I've had a lot of people say, I don't think it'll work. I said, read the book. They come back and they said, how do I help? I want to be a part of it. This is a movement that is transforming the economies. I'm meeting with Governor Dunleavy of Alaska. I'm going to speak in all these states. Read the book. Contact us. We'll have you join this movement. It is not just a book. It is not just a concept. It is a movement. It will be implemented. One fourth of the Florida legislature has read the book, met with me, had dinner with us. Our friend Art Alley pulled a dinner together. We talked to them and they said, we're behind it. Met with Glenn Beck last night and he said, I'm going to start supporting this. We've got to get this movement rolling. The answer is to have every one of your viewers buy a copy of Pirate Money at piratemoneybook.com. You can get it from Amazon. It's on Audible. It's on Kindle. Get this book and read it. It will change the monetary system of America, and it will break this Chinese stranglehold that's coming. It is so disruptive. This is the most disruptive, most powerful thing I've ever been a part of, save the gospel of Jesus Christ himself.
Amen. Let the record show, I'm among that long list of admirers and supporters of this. I had a chance to visit with you and some of the state legislators you've been working with, Kevin. And again, going back to what I said at the beginning, it's a testament to your vision as well as your leadership that this thing is now catching fire across the country. And as you say, it's the one hope that I see for fixing our current currency problems. Everything else is seemingly designed to exacerbate them or, you know, destroy the currency of the United States for that matter. So praise God for your work and your leadership in this as in so many other matters. And again, what you make available to each of us each week at economicwarroom.com, as well as please check out piratemoney.com. Kevin Freeman, God bless you, my friend. Keep up the great work and come back to us with updates at every turn. We're going to actually talk next with somebody from the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and the report you just cited will be one of our topics. Stay tuned for more with Chuck DeVore right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Lieutenant Colonel Chuck DeVore, United States Army National Guard retired. He is a former state legislator in California. These days, he is the chief for national initiatives of a terrific outfit, the Texas Public Policy Foundation. One of the smartest guys we know, as well as a man with considerable expertise to draw upon in making some of, I think, the important analytical contributions and essays and commentaries that he provides in this program and elsewhere about the national security challenges we're facing at the moment. Chuck, it's good to have you with us, as always, sir. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Frank.
I wanted to start because we haven't talked since Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood's Palestinian franchise, invaded Israel with murderous effect a couple of weeks ago. I'd like to get your take on both what has happened to date at the occasion of the invasion, subsequent to it, and what we need to be doing next, as you see it.
Well, certainly Hamas, in their initial objective, was to inflict as much damage on Israel as possible, psychological damage, emotional trauma, sending terrorists out to rape and pillage and torture and take hostage individuals is distinctively not a military operation. This is like something out of a completely different age that I think actors like Genghis Khan might recognize some of these tactics.
Muhammad and, himself. I mean, this is jihad, right.
And so I had predicted early on when I was looking at this, as far as the most dangerous course of action and the most likely course of action. On the most likely course of action, I was figuring that Hamas would calculate that as Israel gathered its forces and prepared to deal a crushing blow to Hamas, that there'd be increasing world pressure from the UN, eventually even from the U.S., for Israel to pull its punch and to, on humanitarian grounds, to pull back. Because, of course, Hamas doesn't think twice about using Palestinian women and children as human shields to try to win the propaganda war, win the information war against Israel, as they seek to do the militarily correct thing in attacking their enemy that has killed and tortured so many of their own citizens. The biggest outbreak of anti-Jewish violence and death and destruction since Hitler's Holocaust. So that's something that is unfortunately beginning to come true right now. You're beginning to see that the world community, such as it is rallying against Israel. And that's all the more reason why it's so important for our president, for our executive branch, for our legislative branch to stand united behind the values of the West, behind civilization in this existential fight between civilization and barbarism. And it's going to be a closely run thing because, of course, you're seeing a changing of the guard with the modern Democratic Party, with younger Democrats being significantly anti-Israel and quite comfortable with what is, in effect, anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic actions and rhetoric, cloaked in this disguise of anti-colonialism or, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, or whatever the latest Marxist BS is that's been promulgated from our university system. Lastly, I mentioned the most dangerous course of action. We keep seeing hints of that, and that's with Iran bringing in its proxies more forcefully, the Lebanese militia, Hezbollah, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, and certainly Hamas in trying to widen the war against Israel and to try to exact significant damage on Israel, as well as to upend diplomatic relations within the Middle East in the pursuit, in Iran's pursuit, the corrupt mullah's pursuit of a Shia caliphate throughout the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much to pick up on in what you said, and I think I agree with it all. One additional line of attack seems to be Iranian-controlled elements in Syria, also part of that northern right. front of Israel at the moment. Before we started talking on air, we talked a little bit about the U.S. response to all of this.
Right.
I think, as you say, while it seems to be increasingly trying to induce the Israelis to have a humanitarian pause or something, a ceasefire, if you will, the United States military has been positioned in the region on the grounds, we're told, of trying to dissuade the Iranians themselves, and I guess right. Hezbollah as well, from really going supernova. The question occurs, Chuck, is that what those carriers in the Eastern Mediterranean are really there for, or does it have more to do with constraining Israel, do you think?
Yeah, I think this is a misapplication of force. I think it's being driven by State Department policy without any illumination or strategic vision from the top. Of course, we have a cognitively challenged president who, even in his best years, was consistently wrong on all significant foreign policy matters. And so essentially,
a figure than former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates made that.
Right, point. Right, exactly. So essentially, you have the State Department running the show. And what you're seeing here is the typical escalation control philosophy that if you hit us enough times, we might do some symbolic strike back because we're afraid of escalation. The problem with this is it cedes entirely the initiative to the Islamic Republic of Iran. They get to attack via their proxies at the time and place of their choosing. And as a result, the likelihood of American service members being wounded or being killed has gone up dramatically because of this incremental, very timid approach. And what I believe and what I've written about, Frank, is that these carrier strike groups are in the wrong sea. They ought to be about 1,500 to 2,000 miles to the east in the Arabian Sea, in the Gulf of Oman. And they ought to be holding Iranian naval assets directly at risk, Iranian oil exports directly at risk, and being prepared to hit Iran where it hurts them the most. It doesn't hurt Iran to strike their proxies. The mullahs in Tehran are perfectly willing to fight to the last Hamas terrorist, the last Hezbollah militiaman, and the last Houthi rebel. And as a result, we are applying our force to the very part of the battlefield that Iran feels the most comfortable losing casualties in. They're perfectly content to do a tit for tat. What we should instead do is take a page
tit for tat with respect to those proxies.
Exactly. And what we should do instead is take a page from the Reagan administration in 1987 and 88, when you had the tanker war heating up between Iran and Iraq. And both nations were beginning to attack neutral tanker traffic. Kuwait came to us and said, we'd like U.S. Navy escort. We said, that's fine, but you have to reflag your tankers under U.S. flag, have a U.S. captain, half the crew has to be U.S. And we started to do that. And prior to doing that, Frank, we did some war gaming in the Pentagon, and we had two different branches that we looked at if Iran started to mess with our escorts. Branch one was the typical State Department attack. It was kind of this incremental response. If you hit us, we'll hit you back. And you know, we're afraid of escalation because, of course, the Soviet Union was still around and it's the Cold War. The other was a more robust, more of a DOD-centric cell. And what we did, and I was part of that, was with the initial response, we just sent a demarche to Iran and said, if you do anything again, we're going to take a surface action group that'd be focused on an Iowa-class battleship, and we're going to start at the Straits of Hormuz. And we're going to destroy everything of military value within 20 miles of the coast until you cry uncle. And as it ended up happening, 9 months later, we had Operation Praying Mantis in response to a U.S. frigate being severely damaged by an Iranian mine put into international waters, wounded 10 sailors. 4 days later, we unleashed Operation Praying Mantis, the largest U.S. Navy surface action since World War II. We sank five Iranian ships. We destroyed two militarized offshore oil platforms. I think there was about 54 Iranian deaths to two U.S. crew members on a Cobra. And we still to this day don't know if they were shot down or had a mechanical. And then Iran wasn't heard of for months and years afterwards. They were silent. And oh, by the way, the tanker war ended. The tanker war ended, right? That's how you deal with people like the mullahs in Iran. You deal with them from a position of strength. You don't allow them to control the pace of escalation.
Right. Peace through strength, as our old boss, Ronald Reagan, used to say. And I remember fondly our time in the Pentagon together. Chuck, thank you for your service in that capacity, among others. Lastly, you mentioned Marxist BS. I won't ask you to define the term BS, but I think we know what you mean. Five United States senators went to the well of the Senate or the floor of the Senate yesterday to inveigh against one of their colleagues, Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, who has put a hold on the idea of just blanket promotion approvals of members of the military who are supposed to take senior positions. There's always the option of doing them one by one, but the Senate Majority Leader has not wanted to do that.
Right.
The reason was initially over the, I think, illegal use of federal funds for abortion, but Tommy Tuberville has helped expose that a lot of these general officer candidates, flag officer candidates, are enthusiasts for the so-called woke agenda, the BS Marxist, I think, more accurately, agenda. I got 20 seconds. What are your thoughts on promoting such individuals?
Yeah, this has increasingly become a problem, and it kind of grows out of the military's response to the Vietnam War, where they thought they needed more interaction with the academy, right, with higher education, getting advanced degrees. And so as a result, we've had fewer warriors and more Washington, D.C. insiders get promoted to high rank.
Yeah, and I fear we will find that a disadvantage if a shooting war begins. Chuck DeVore, thank you for your time, my friend. God bless you. Keep up the great work at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Come back to us soon. Be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Senate rhinos are relentlessly attacking their colleague, Tommy Tuberville, for wisely insisting that promotions of hundreds of top officers be approved individually, since many embrace a Marxist agenda imperiling our armed forces. Purges of patriots and those who refuse the jab, compounded by critical race brainwashing, are crushing the service's recruitment goals. The Pentagon can, however, find lots of fit young men of color to fill the ranks. It has a program that allows illegal aliens to enlist and get fast-tracked for citizenship. Barack Obama promised to fundamentally transform America. In the course of this third Obama-Biden term, doing that to our military has rapidly advanced and would result in its inevitable takedown if we put foreign jihadists, Chinese special forces, and other enemies in our uniforms. Will any senator stand with Coach Tuberville in exposing and opposing this unfolding disaster? This is Frank Affney. Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Jonathan Emord. He is an attorney by training, a constitutional attorney at that, by avocation. He is also, as it happens, a candidate for the United States Senate from the Commonwealth of Virginia, and a good friend of this program. We always enjoy our visits because he brings a lot of clarity and, I think, courage to the topics we discuss. The one I wanted to visit with him a bit about is one that requires it, frankly, even to discuss, let alone do so with clarity and integrity. It involves the problem that we now are confronting with respect to a phenomenon I think is best described as Sharia supremacism. Sharia being the Islamic doctrine, the operating code, if you will, of Islam. Not all Muslims subscribe to it. The ones who do are considered by the authorities faithful Muslims. And there are a lot of them. And unfortunately, they feel impelled by divine dictate to engage in jihad, to impose their program of Sharia worldwide, including here in the United States. Jonathan Emord is a man who I believe, having just come back from the border, has some insights into who's coming into this country that might give further reason for concern about what is the intent of not only the people coming in, not all, but many, and also people that they're marrying up with here. I'm particularly concerned about those associated with a group called the Muslim Brotherhood. And for that matter, the Shia version of it, sponsored by the Iranian regime, notably Hezbollah. Jonathan, welcome back, sir. It is always good to visit with you, but especially at a time such as this.
Yeah, I think we, you know, all of us start from the premise that we're entitled to our religious liberty under the Constitution. But when you use religion as a cover for terrorist activity, you no longer have the benefit of being able to claim yourself to be committed to any religion. Those who, all over the world, they're Muslims, and most of them are peaceful people. And then we have radicals. We have radicals in the Middle East who are dedicated to the destruction of Israel. They are dedicated to the destruction of the United States. And we have this southern border that's wide open. I mean, totally wide open. I just came back from there. They've reassigned the Border Patrol agents to human processing centers. And there are very few who are guarding the border, and the border is really unguarded. In my correspondence with this person after I left the border, he said, you know, Jonathan, with regard to Hamas declaring a jihad against all Christians and Jews worldwide, I now reflect upon the fact that over the last 2 years, I've witnessed just an enormous number of people from the Middle East, many of whom I know to be affiliated with Hamas or Islamic Jihad or ISIS, come into the United States, and we were barred from taking any action against them because we are only allowed to act against them if they're on the terrorist watch list. So he said, we are in a situation where there are likely cells across the United States. And I think we've seen that manifested in a lot of the protests, both on college campuses and across the country, where they're feeding into this movement of anti-Semitism to attack Jews and really place the Jewish population in the United States in a state of perpetual risk. We have got to be protective of the Jewish population in this country because of that risk.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's not just the Jews. That's Christians. True. It's anybody who stands against the triumph of Islam. And to your point as to just how serious the threat is, even Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, in testimony earlier this week, professed real concern about the prospect that we're facing real threats to the interior of this country. He didn't say specifically from the people coming in across the border, or he didn't say specifically from their marrying up with this infrastructure. And he didn't say specifically that it was jihadis that he was worried about. All right. Of that was kind of implied. But whatever he thinks the problem is, that is part of the problem we're facing, I believe, to be sure.
I think, you know, he is, what he articulated there was really rather disgraceful in the sense that he is fully cognizant of that the open border situation has invited in all of these people across the country, and they have no idea where they are. This is a situation where we have
no idea where they are. We've helped distribute them around the country. Worse yet.
From those human processing centers, what I witnessed was they process them. And what that means is they sign them up for welfare. They sign them up for food stamps. They give them cash. They identify sources for free education, free medical care, free taxpayers' expense, and NG cell phones. And then in addition, they drive them from the human processing centers to the airport, the train station, the bus terminal, wherever they want to go in the United States. And NGOs at those locations that are fully federally funded, that's all the money they receive, pay for their tickets to go anywhere in the United States. And this is everybody except those on the terrorist watch list or Interpol identified as criminals. Everybody is let in.
Let me just say, we had an interview yesterday with our friend Trevor Loudon, and he said that even people on the terrorism watch list are in some cases now being admitted as well. I mean, this is insanity. And Jonathan, I want to see if we can hold you over for another block if we can. But this is so frightening because it's happening at a moment when the Biden administration is not only pursuing these policies at the border, they are actually empowering Muslim Brotherhood operatives as advisors, as well as officials of our government.
Yes.
And is it any wonder that things are going from bad to worse? Jonathan, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to visit with you a little bit about the president's personal meeting with top Muslim Brotherhood figures in the United States just last week. Stay tuned. You're not going to want to miss this. Welcome back. We're continuing our really important conversation with Jonathan Emord, a man who has clarity on so many issues of great importance to our nation. He is a constitutional attorney by training, the author of The Authoritarians, a really important book about the history of totalitarianism, as well as its presence in our own country. And he is, among other things, a candidate for the United States Senate in Virginia. Jonathan, I just wanted to introduce to you and our audience something that I found very concerning about the president's meeting with what were described as American Muslim leaders last week. There were three in particular that have longstanding ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. This is a group that, as you know, has as its, you know, mission destroying Western civilization from within, right, by our hands and the hands of the believers. This is from their own archives, discovered in a serendipitous, I should say, FBI raid a decade and a half ago or so in Northern Virginia, no less. But the point is that Keith Ellison, who used to be a member of Congress, is now the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota and the executive director of a group called M-Gage, that is a Muslim Brotherhood political action committee, and another fellow by the name of Imam Mohammed Majid, a prominent figure in your constituency. He runs a huge mosque complex called the Adams Center here. Those three individuals were there, I'm quite sure, telling the president of the sorts of things that he needs to do with respect to Israel, the sorts of things he needs to do to accommodate more Muslims, the things he promised to do before the election in the meeting with M-Gage, in which he said he would put Muslims throughout his administration if elected, and has done so. When you look at this problem of large numbers, and frankly, it's not just cells that I'm worried about. We have divisions worth of jihadis who have come into this country. Just take the 70 to 100,000 that the president himself admitted from Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, right, after he surrendered the place to them. I mean, this is an internal security threat of the first order, and it's clear that as the director of the FBI said, we're not tracking that, those networks, those individual jihadist terrorists. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, this is a situation where the president of the United States and the entire Biden administration has embraced, many Democrats on the Hill have embraced the notion that we should put down our arms and leave ourselves defenseless against a deluge of individuals who are radicals intent on destroying this country. It's insanity. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But this is the appeasement policy of the Biden administration, to embrace the enemies of the United States, and not only that, to allow them to have currency throughout our country and throughout the administration. Mm. So,
empowering them, in other words.
Empowering them.
Including in senior positions. Get this. The director for intelligence on the National Security Council is a Palestinian activist who had previously been involved with Students for Justice in Palestine, a Brotherhood front operation on college campuses. We're seeing evidence of its virulence in many of them these days. He's the guy who also worked for the UN agency that funds Hamas, UNRWA.
Yeah,
and he's sitting there at the choke point of intelligence between the White House and the intelligence community and the government. I mean, yeah, this is insane.
The degree of infiltration by enemies of the United States on the state and national level that is absolutely astounding, and the results of which will be not just the external explosion type of terrorism, but the internal implosion terrorism that comes about when you allow the enemies of this country to infest the infrastructure and then eat it away of the Constitution, of the Republic. And really, we are at dire risk And so many people are cognizant of it, yet so few are able to do anything about it because this administration has disarmed its opposition through censorship and through all other means.
Intimidation. In some cases, prosecution. And you know, to your...
Liberally using the term Islamophobia against anyone who dares threaten that the universe of jihadis and efforts to destroy this country. Anyone who stands up in defense of the United States against the radical Islamists will immediately be deemed guilty of Islamophobia. That's the tactic. That's the use of social popular leftist language to redefine people who are merely standing in defense of our country as those who are enemies of our country. And they do it by just calling us out as Islamophobic people.
Right. And that's I've been branded by it myself. I can tell you it's
many times.
It's not a picnic. But let me just say that we've just had Kamala Harris, the vice president, announce that she and Joe Biden are going to launch a new campaign against Islamophobia. And again, this is not a matter of hostility towards Muslims. This is a matter of trying, as you say, to protect our country against people who invoke Islam and the teachings of it under Sharia to try to destroy our country.
All over Northern Virginia, I have met with Muslims who are peaceful, peace-loving people who adhere to the true tenets of their faith and would never, ever condone or support any of this type of activity of violence or destruction of this nation. And what has happened is the radicals have blurred the distinctions and tried to insinuate, you know, it's the same policy they're using in the Gaza Strip, where they are using civilian structures and even mosques as protection shields against the terrorist activity. It's an analogy that is applicable in our own country, too. And yet the Biden administration is intentionally blind to it.
Yeah. Well, there's unfortunately a track record of this going back several administrations. But you're right. It's happening now and we cannot afford it. It will get us killed. Jonathan Emord, thank you for your time today, sir, for your courage and for your willingness to get in the arena. God bless you.
Well, you bet.
Look forward to talking with you again soon and to the rest of you next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.